It's good for you.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Okay.
Okay, good evening, and thank you all for joining us tonight. I want to start by acknowledging the incredible work of my committee in coordinating each CBY Adult Ed event. Their dedication, along with support from our rabbinic and administrative team, helped make our programming possible. Tonight, it's really a pleasure for me to introduce someone that I know as a Torah scholar, an educational leader, and also as a friend. I remember taking classes with Dr. Goldstein at Stern and at Revel. I think I remember, have distinct memories from the Jewish Christian polemics class with Dr. Berger, where, just to show what a small world it is, where the rabbi of our shul, Rabbi Schreier, recently shared with me is the class in which he met his wife. So we all like share that. Nice, you know. You'll go back there together. After receiving her master's from Yeshiva University in Jewish philosophy, Dr. Goldstein completed her joint PhD in Judaic studies and medieval history at NYU. Since, she has made her mark in Bergen County as Rebbetzin of Herschel and Fairlawn and as a teacher in Mayanote High School, among other places. And all of this while balancing raising a family and making such a positive influence on the community around her. Dr. Goldstein and her family have made Aliyah, and she founded Amudim, which is a gap year program for women in Israel, where she also serves as Rosh Midrasha. Dr. Goldstein's scholarship, along with her dynamic and engaging personality, make it so meaningful and memorable to learn with her and from her. The topic for tonight's presentation is Of Cavemen and Man Caves, Plato and Bar Yochai on Statesmen and Sages. We're so happy to have you here with us in person. So please join me in warmly welcoming Dr. Julie Goldstein.
Thank you so much. It is truly a pleasure. It is not a platitude when I say I am so excited to be back in my old stomping grounds in Bergen County. I lived for many years in Fairlawn, and I taught for a bunch of years in Mayanote. So I feel like it's to some extent a homecoming. So really, I thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you to the Bnei Asherim community for warmly re-welcoming me into the community. And I'm so happy to be learning with you tonight in anticipation of Yom HaTzma'ut and Shavuot. And we have very beautiful, special days ahead of us. So thank you very much. Let's get right into it. And let's get a little bit personal. I'll tell you that my favorite TV show is The Twilight Zone, the old Twilight Zone. Not Black Mirror, the modern version of it, or any of the other iterations, but the black and white 1960s show Twilight Zone. And in that series, there is one episode called, maybe some of you will recognize it, Time Enough at Last. Do you know that episode? Have you ever? It's an incredibly thought-provoking and wonderful show in general. And this specific episode is going to be very relevant to our discussion tonight. It's about a guy named Bemis who loves books. He's a bibliophile. And he wants to devour books all the time. He always has his nose in a book, and his wife drives him crazy. Get your nose out of the book. You gotta go to work. You gotta do this. You gotta go shopping. You gotta take a shower. You gotta live your life. Get your head out of the clouds. Get your nose out of the book. And his boss at work is hounding him to do actual work, and he just wants to be, whether it's in the world of literature, the world of ideas, whatever kind of satisfaction that the books are giving him, he wants to be in that world, and he doesn't want to be in the real world, right? And so in this, and I don't want to give anything away, spoilers, I'm not going to give, the crux away, but at some point when all the noise of the real world is driving him crazy, and he's a teller in a bank, he decides, all these people always bothering me, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to make money, you have to whatever, go shopping, right? He decides to go into the vault of the bank, and he goes into the vault. Is it ringing a bell for anybody here? You should go YouTube it, watch it. It's so Jewish. It's so Jewish. There, you know, I think the sources that we're going to look at today are going to show you how much Rothschild, whoever, you know, might have had in mind some Jewish ideas when he created this particular episode and some other episodes of the Twilight Zone as well. And he goes into the vault of the bank and he closes the big steel door and everything is quiet. And he's able to take out his book that he's been trying to read all day. And he sits and he reads the book. And then suddenly, poof, like he hears a big blast, a big explosion. And the vault kind of shakes a little bit. And he opens the door and some kind of apocalyptic episode incident must have happened. The world is destroyed. And he goes outside and there's nothing. Everybody's gone. Bodies strewn all over the place and cars turned upside down. And it's just, shaking your head. You remember this, right? He goes around and there's nothing there. And first he's scandalized and, this is hugely upsetting. And then he comes across, a supermarket. He has all the food he wants. He's the only person because he was in that vault. He's the only person left alive. So at first he's a little bit panicking, right? But then he sees he has enough food to last a lifetime. He has and as many houses to serve as accommodations for the rest of his life. And he comes across the library, right? He has an endless amount of time to just be with his books, finally. No chatter in his ear, no nagging by anybody. He can just be in his world of books. And there's a lot of different themes in there. Bemis is a dork, right? So he's the short guy with glasses. And I really don't want to give it away, but it's so good. The ending is so good. You know it is. The glasses are supposed to represent his kind of like short-sightedness, right? I think a few of us, especially those who are kind of like academically or intellectually inclined, can relate to Bemis. We like books and we like the world of ideas, right? But the fact that he has these glasses and his glasses are highly symbolic and they play a very important role, say something about his short-sightedness. You know, Bemis would be a much more likable person if only he could find value not only in the imaginary people that he has in his books, but in his literature, but if he could find value in actually engaging with his fellow human beings, right? That's by way of introduction to the Gemaras that we're about to look at together, the narratives that we're about to look at together, which, maybe not. No, there's no interviews that we can look at in order to confirm this. This episode was based on. At the very least, this episode reminded me of these Gemaras in Masechet Shabbat and in Masechet Brachot. So, if you'll indulge me and look at the sources on your sheet, we're going to go through it together. And I think that the general story narrative that we're going to look at will be familiar to you, but I don't know if you've ever parsed out some of the themes here. Okay, these are the stories, the narratives about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave. Right? And it says as follows. We'll start with the first source on your sheet and we'll skip around a little bit. We're not going to read everything. You have the English there. And you can take this home for reading more in depth if you'd like, afterwards. But it says as follows. Azlu, they went. Tashu ba'marata, right? They went into a cave. It rachesh nisa ivrei lahu, and they went to the cave and there were these things created for them. Charuva, right? A carob tree. Ve'ena demaya, a spring of water. Vahavu mishalche manahu, vahavu yatve ad savarehu bachala. And they would remove their clothes. This is Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, Rashbi, as he's affectionately known as, right? Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his son went to hide from the Romans in a cave, and they had all these things, these miracles occur for them, of a carob tree growing in order to provide them food, and they had a spring of water so that they could have water, and they would remove their clothes and sit covered in sand up to their necks, and they would study Torah all day, and only when it was time for davening, time for prayer, they would dress themselves, cover themselves, and pray, and then immediately they would go back to their modus operandi, their regular way of operating, and they would disrobe, take off their clothes, which was, you know, how they regularly were when they weren't davening, and they would go back into their learning and being covered up and said buried kind of like in sand. And it says in this excerpt that they sat in the cave for 12 years until Eliyahu Hanavi came and stood at the entrance of the cave and said, who's going to tell these guys that, you know, the Romans are not a threat anymore and they can come out of the cave, right? So we have this notion, first of all, of a cave. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is in Bemis's vault, so to speak, right? He retreats from society. He goes into this like, almost like a womb-like state, right? Where he's entirely provided for. There's food being, there's miracles that occur for him. He has food, he has water, he has everything he needs. By the way, already, you can already start to put the pieces together, symbolically speaking. Where else in Tanakh do we have people who are in this kind of idyllic setting where they're naked, or I guess a nicer word is nude, right? And they have everything provided for them. Adam HaRishon, right? He's in an Edenic existence, right? This is Eden. This is a recreation of Eden. This is a place of entirely dependent upon miracles and God. And is he going out to work every day in order to make money and support himself and be able to go and get food and whatever? No. He has the umbilical cord of Hashem, so to speak. Hashem is providing everything for him, and his son, and the Ma'ara, the cave, is his retreat. He's retreated from society, and he's living. And it says, it's very clear at the very end, Eliyahu HaNavi says, doesn't he know that there's time, meaning that a time has come, right? We've hit a natural point in time in which things have changed, right? There's fluctuations in time. Now the emperor is gone, he can come out of the cave. And the answer to Eliyahu HaNavi is no. He doesn't know that things have changed, that there's flux in the world. He's living a timeless existence. He's not aware of time. He doesn't know that history is happening around him and that something has changed. He's living in a world of eternality, right? Timelessness, a world of endless time. He's not watching the clock. There is no clock there. There's no alarms. There's nothing ticking. He's just in a kind of eternal kind of existence, he and his son. And it says as follows, it goes on in Gemara and Shabbos. Nafku, they left. He and his son leave the cave. Chazu inshe deka karve vizra'e, and they see people, real people, outside who are plowing and sowing. Amar, and they say, they're shocked when they see these people who are actually going to work, right? Menichen chaye olam v'oskin b'chaye sha'ah. How is this possible? Why are these people doing this? These people are forsaking an eternal life, the world of eternality, for a temporal existence, for chaye sha'ah, for a life that's regulated by the clock. Why would anybody want to live this way, right? They love that world of eternality that they were experiencing back in the cave. Kol makom shenotnin einehem miyad nisraf. Everywhere that they would look, they would destroy, right? Now we know that in general, the way the Gemara works, it's not, the Chazal weren't there, you know, they're not reporters, they're not reporting history. They're not standing there like, oh, let it just chronicle what's happening here. There happened to be a Rav Shimon Bar Yochai who had laser vision, with laser eyes, and was destroyer. When they speak this way, they are trying to tell us something deeper. They're trying to talk metaphorically and symbolically. It's not that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, they're telling us that he had, laser beams coming out of his eyes, which doesn't really happen in real life. They're saying that somehow he was unable to perceive reality in the way that it should be perceived, right? And he had a distorted view. He had a distorted view of reality, and he can't really wrap his mind around real existence. He thinks that everybody should be almost like back in the Beis Medrash, right? Everybody should live like Adam Harishon in Edenic existence, just you and God, and basking in the glory of Torah, which is what they were doing. They were studying Torah in the cave, and God provides for you, and you don't have to worry about plowing and sowing and making money and stuff like that, right? And he can't, he can't believe it. And so there's an incompatibility between his worldview and the reality as it exists. And so, the Gemara tells us that his eyes, burn everything up until a bat kol comes out and says, what are you doing destroying my world? Get yourself back into the cave. And they go back into the cave, says the Gemara, for 12 months, right? And 12 months is hugely symbolic when you think about what 12 months is. And the Gemara actually tells us that it's associated with Gehenna, right? It says they again went and sat there for 12 months. They said the judgment of the wicked in Gehenna lasts for 12 months. So when God, with a bat kol, tells them to go back into the cave for 12 months, whereas before the first time in the cave, they were living a Gan Eden existence, the second time they're in the cave, they're not going into the cave to live a Gan Eden existence, a utopian existence, right? They're going back into the cave because they're being punished like it's Gehenna. This is a hellish existence. It's an inversion of the first time that they were in the cave, until finally a divine voice emerges again and says to them, "Emerge from your cave." They emerge, and everywhere still, his son, kind of like his son Rabbi Lazar, he's not really able to reconcile his eternal existence with the temporal existence outside. So he's still a destroyer. His eyes are still destroying things. But Rav Shimon Bar Yochai learns his lesson from being in Gehenna in the cave for 12 months, and he becomes the great healer. Everywhere that his son's eyes went and destroyed, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai heals. And Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says to Elazar, "My son, you and I suffice for the entire world as the two of us are engaged in the proper study of Torah. We'll take this little bit of the semblance of eternality with us into the real world. And the two of us are enough to sustain the world." And so we have this notion of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his son as wanting to be in a world of Kol HaTorah Kula, a world of ideas, not in a world of actual work and, you know, transience, what they see as a world of transience. They want Chaye Olam, which is Olam means like forever, a life of forever. And God kind of has to massage this in some way until they understand that there's some virtue to chayei sha'ah, to actual real kind, a real kind of existence. When we're talking about in kind of like, I guess, halachic terms or even agricultural terms, what you might call Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's approach is, you know, Olam Shakulo Shemitah. That's what Shemitah is about also. A little bit, we'll incorporate a little bit of Eretz Yisrael into this also. Shemitah is the year of the cave. It's the year where we say, let the land, we're not going to work the land. We're not going to plow and sow the land and do the hard work, right? We're going to sit back and we're going to live this Edenic existence where God is going to provide for us. Somehow it's going to work out, right? But most of the year, most of our years are not spent in Shemitah land. Most of our lives are the temporal, hardworking, real existence. And once every 7 years, we take we take a kind of like cues from Shimon Bar Yochai, and we live the Shemitah-like existence. Mm-hmm. So you might call the original Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, before he comes out of the cave and he learns his lesson, we might call him Shemitah man, you know? He wants to live a kind of like Shemitah, like existence, and God says no. And he puts him in Gehenna, in that cave, for 12 months until he learns how to kind of like incorporate the two. You know, it's not only in this Gemara, but in other Gemaras too that kind of reinforce Rav Shimon Bar Yochai as the guy, as the Tana, who struggles with this kind of relationship. So if you go to, if you turn over your page and you go into the Gemara in Brachos, you see this characterization of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in other places in the Gemara. So, so you look in Brachos Lamed Hey Amud Aleph, it says, essentially, just to give you a little bit of background, the Gemara is asking, it's talking about Kriyat Shema. It's talking about something that's not an Agada, it's not talking about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai ostensibly. It's talking about Kriyat Shema, and it's asking the question, why does it have to say in Kriyat Shema that we're able to work, that it says V'asafta Deganecha? Okay, so it says, Tanu Rabbanan va'asafta deganecha ma Talmud lomar. Why does Kriyat Shema have to tell us that we have to gather our grain? We all know we have to work. Why is Kriyat Shema telling us that, right? Lofishine amar lo yamush sefer haTorah hazeh mipicha. Because there's another pasuk that tells us that you should always have Torah in your mouth. So that's why Kriyat Shema has to say, oh, when we say you should always have Torah in your mouth, that doesn't preclude you from actually having to work. You also have to, asafta deganecha, you also have to sometimes come out of the base medrash and also work, right? But the reason why Kriyat Shema has to do that is because we might be misled into thinking that we don't have to work from this pasuk that tells us, stay in the base medrash all your life. Go to Kolel, right? Yachol dvarim kechtavan, right? Could it really be that that's what it's saying? Ba'asafta diganecha hanheg bahem minhag derech eretz divrei Rabbi Yishmael. So Rabbi Yishmael comes along and says, that's why it says in Kriyat Shema ba'asafta diganecha, to remind all of us that we can't stay in Kolel all our lives, we can't stay in the Beis Medrash, we can't stay in Rashbi's cave, whatever, we have to work. And then, you know, just to continue, Rav Shimon ben Yochai Omer, okay, this is a sugya that's about Kriyat Shema. So it's interesting. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai suddenly comes in because he's the guy who has this particular approach to working versus non-working. So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai comes in and he says, "Efshar adam choresh b'chshad harishav zoreya b'shat zriya v'kotzer b'shat ksira v'dash b'shat tisha v'zore b'shat haruach Torah matahe aleha." If everybody's going working and plowing and sowing and threshing and winnowing and all, who's going to be learning Torah? Remember, he's the one who's going to bring us back to this notion. No, people, please don't be misled into thinking that you should actually work by the fact that Kriyat Shema says Vasafta Dignecha. What's going to happen to Torah if all you people are going to be working, right? Who's going to be upholding the learning of Torah? Ela bizman she Yisrael osin ritzono shel makon lachten asit ayit eacharim. Don't worry, people, please go back to Kolel, go back to the cave, go back to the Beis Medrash. Somebody else will do the work. I promise you, if you go back to the Beis Medrash and you go back to Kolel, somebody else is going to do the work. Ba'amdu zarim bar'u, you know, and he brings a proof text. Ubizman she'ein Yisrael osin ritono shel makon lachten aseit adei etzman. And if you don't, you know, go back into the Beis Medrash, then you're going to have to do dirty work. And that's not what you want. Va'asafta deganecha v'lo od ela shemalechet acharim naseit ayidei adam va'adat, and it goes on and on and on and on. So Rashbi again, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai again argues for a kind of like existential, spiritual, scholarly existence that transcends time. You should, you know, this is all talking about threshing at a certain time and winnowing at a certain time. And he's like, please, please, don't do that. Amar Abaye Harbe Asuk Rabbi Yishmael V'Al Tav Yadan K'Rabbi Yishmael Bar Yochai V'Lo Al Tav Yadan. And essentially, the Gemara says there are some people who took Rabbi Yishmael's position and went to work and whatever it is, and kind of like a combined working for a living and learning Torah, and they were successful in their Torah study, and some acted in accordance with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, and they were not successful in their Torah study. So like he's, you know, some and some, live and let live. You know, some people will choose one path, some will choose another. So in the Gemara in general, Rav Shimon bar Yochai is a figure. He's who represents this notion that we should retreat from society and go and learn Kol HaTorah Kula, you know, and not work and live this eternal kind of existence. And he's a mouthpiece for that kind of position, not only in the narratives about the caves, but throughout the Gemara, which is, yes.
There's one pasuk which says, Shkeshis Kuman Ta'asemlo.
Yeah.
And there's another pasuk that says, Shkeshis Kuman Ta'asemlo.
Okay.
So we say, Bizman shared it. They're doing this one, and Ta'o said, by others.
Yeah, no, yeah, of course. I'm not coming here to talk about the virtues or the vices or, you know, the pitfalls or the advantages of what Rav Shimon bar Yochai is saying. I want to try to understand, and that's why we have to go back to the Gemara and Shabbos right now. It's a very good segue, so I thank you. Try to understand what the Gemara, at the end of the day, wants us to do. Right? Because we do have these very two streams of thought. And we have to try to somehow reconcile them and figure out, at the end, tachlis, how are we supposed to approach this, right? And so going back to the first page to the Gemara and Shabbos, there is an ending to this sugya, and it's extremely important and vital towards understanding at the end of the day what the message is that we're supposed to glean from this, right? And it's also very symbolic in nature. And this is essentially what it tells us. It's this second to last, you know, little section here on the first page and it tells us, and you've probably heard this before, as the sun was setting, Bein Hashmashot, and that this notion of Bein Hashmashot, all of these little details are hugely important because we were just told that when they're in the cave, they're not aware of time, right? It's eternal kind of existence. So what's Bein Hashmashot, halachically speaking? Bein Hashmashot, it's a Friday, and it's Bein Hashmashot. Bein Hashmashot is a liminal kind of space. It's that the Bein Hashmashot is halachically ambiguous, right? One moment, it's not Shabbat, it's Chol. And then the next moment, it is Shabbat. It's Kadosh. And Bein Hashmashot is that in betwixt and between kind of a time that would probably drive somebody like Rav Shimon bar Yochai crazy, right? Because he's a person who's trying to wrap his mind around an eternal existence where there's no sense of time. And then reality, where everybody's going to work, where it's always, everybody's on the clock and there are deadlines and you have to show up for work on time and you have to, right? And you're getting paid by the hour and whatever it is. And there are contracts. Bein Hashmashot is that space that's between those two worlds. So it's very important, it's very instructive, it's very telling that when we're getting to the crescendo of this sugya, it tells us that Rav Shimon bar Yochai learns his lesson Bein Hashmashot at a time that's betwixt and between the two worlds that he's kind of that he's wrestling with. So Bein Hashmashot, as the sun was setting on the Shabbat Eve, he sees an elderly man holding two bundles of hadasim, right? And essentially flowers, right? Two branches, and he's running at twilight. And he says to him, "What are you doing? Why are you running with these flowers?" And he says to them, "I'm honoring the Shabbat. I'm fulfilling, you know, Shamor and Zachor, right?" And when Rav Shimon bar Yochai sees that, one of the myrtle branches, he says, is corresponding to Shamor. One is corresponding to Zachor. And when Rav Shimon bar Yochai sees that, he turns to his son. He says, "Oh, see how, you know, the Jewish people love their mitzvot. See how precious are the mitzvot are to Bnei Israel." And his mind was put at ease, and he was no longer upset that people were living chaye sha'a. He was no longer upset that people were living this kind of like temporal existence. Okay, so I ask you. Okay. It's a very obscure, very weird way to end. What is this trying to tell us? What is this, right? Let's start with the fact that when he sees this guy running home with two flowers in his hand, And he says, what are you doing? The guy says, I'm doing Shamor and Zachor. How technically, from a halachic standpoint, how do we fulfill Shamor and Zachor? When we say we're Shomer Shabbos, what does it mean that we're Shomer Shabbos? It means, how are people Shomer Shabbat? It means that they refrain from doing certain things. We're talking about the lavim. We're talking about the things that you're not allowed, the malachot that you're not allowed to do. When we say we're Shomer Shabbat, the way we fulfill the mitzvah, the halacha of Shamor at Yom HaShabbat, is by not doing malacha. And how do we fulfill Zachor at Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho? By saying Kiddush, right? That's a mitzvah aseh, right? We have to say Kiddush. It's something that we proactively do. It's a positive mitzvah. So this guy is running with two flowers and he says, oh, I'm doing Shamor and Zachor. Is that what he's doing? Is he doing Shamor? Is he saying Kiddush or refraining from doing Malacha? Is he fulfilling the mitzvot, the technical mitzvot of Shamor and Zachor? He's not. And so that clued me in to what the Gemara might be trying to tell us. He's bringing flowers home, maybe to his wife, maybe to his children, maybe for his own sake, because he likes flowers, he wants flowers on his Shabbos table. But there's zero halachic significance, actual halachic significance to what he's doing. And yet, he claims that he's fulfilling the halachot of Shamor and Zachor by bringing home these flowers. What's the message to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai when he says that? Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, you'll remember, is somebody who likes a world that's objective, where everything is set up for him, where there's no kind of vicissitudes of life that get in the way. You don't know if you're going to get your paycheck on time, or you don't know if you're going to have your job the next day. You might be fired. Somebody, God forbid, might die. You might lose your house. There might be a recession. That's the real world. That's the world of history. That's the world of reality. That's the world that we all live in. That's a world of flux where not everything always occurs as there might be a global pandemic for 3 years or whatever it is, right? Rav Shimon Bar Yochai wants to be in a cave of objective truth. The objective truth is called Torah, where everything is provided. God, you know, God is going to provide the carob tree and the water is always going to be there. And everything is just as would be expected. And the world of halacha, according to somebody like Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, is objective. You know exactly what the rule is, and you know exactly how to perform that rule. And that's when he hears Shamor and Zachor, he's aligning it with the world of the cave, where it's a world of objectivity, a world of truth, a world of very clear expectations and rules. It functions by very predictable kind of rules. But this guy holding the flowers says to him, no, dude, these flowers are Shamor and Zachor. Shamor and Zachor, halacha, Judaism, is not just about objective rules. Let's say, saying Kiddush and refraining from the 39 malachot. But Shabbos, the laws of Shabbos, the religious life, also includes subjective elements, human elements, human emotions, which are always in flux. And always, unpredictable, right? When I take these flowers, I think flowers are pretty. Flowers are enhance my Shabbos experience. Flowers give me oneg, right? This is also part of Judaism. It's not just the rules, the very clear objective rules that constitute the religious experience. The religious experience also includes subjective human elements. And that's when Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, the Jewish people, right, the Jewish people, B'nai Israel, really understand that you can have both, that Judaism and Jewish life includes both the objective, halacha, the rules, but also the subjective human experience, predilections, desires, concerns. God wants all of it. And Shabbos is Shamor and Zachor with Kiddush and bless you, and following halacha, right? Being Shomer Shabbat, but it's also having flowers on your table if that's what appeals to you, right? And that's kind of the end of this sugya, where he learns his lesson. He's like, I can be in both worlds. This man has taught me that I can have both a shamor and zachor that's objective, and a shamor and zachor that's subjective. And then the first thing that he does, if you look at the last part over here, this is the last part in the Gemara and Shabbos. The first thing he does is he says, since a miracle amar ho'il v'itrachesh nisa, because a miracle happened to me, azil atikin milta, I am going to go and repair something. I'm going to go and do a tikkun. I'm going to go do tikkun olam. And he goes ostensibly, the Gemara suggests that the first thing that he does is he goes out into the world and he establishes bathhouses and currency marketplaces, right? He does like numismatics or whatever. He makes coins, and he becomes part of the economy. He goes almost the opposite way. Before he was like really, really in the Beis Medrash and the Kollel, and now he's like an economist. He's like building societal structures, right? It's interesting also, we have there's so much to talk about here. The fact that they would kind of like erased their body when they were in the cave, right? They were only focusing on ideas, and they weren't focusing on their physical. That's why they were naked, but they were they buried themselves every day up to their necks in sand, as if to ignore their bodies. And that part actually isn't on the source sheet. You can go. It's a very long sugya in Shabbat Lamed Gimel Amud Bet. When he comes out, his son-in-law says to him, Pinchas ben Ya'ir says to him, Rav Shimon bar Yochai, first thing we got to do is we got to take you to the bathhouse and we got to repair all your wounds. You've been neglecting your body for so long. You've just been in the world of the mind. You've just been in your ivory tower of learning Torah for so long. You've neglected your body so much. We got to get you more in touch with your body. We got to put band-aids on. We got to put ointments on. He brings them to the bathhouse. And this is all part of Rav Shimon bar Yochai's rediscovery of his physical humanity and his relationship with the society as it really is, and then he establishes marketplaces and currencies and all these kind of things, right? So this whole sugya sets up this dichotomy between an eternal existence, a world of Shemitah, a world of objectivity, a world of predictability, and versus a world of temporality, a world of reality, of transience, of fleeting, human, subjective kinds of things. And I think that we can see this kind of play out, and perhaps the truth is, perhaps the rabbis, Chazal, were aware of this, because Chazal might have been aware of Plato, which is what we're going to look at next or talk about very as briefly as I can, due to Hellenism. Plato pre-existed. The Greek wisdom, right, and Greek philosophy pre-existed Chazal, and that's why we have so many discussions in the Talmud about whether we are allowed to study Greek wisdom, because Greek philosophy pre-existed. So especially during the Hellenistic period, during the times of the Maccabees, right, during the times of Yavan, it could be that Chazal had read Plato, knew about Plato's metaphor of the cave, and specifically constructed the narratives about Rav Shimon bar Yochai in the cave in order to respond and react to Plato's narrative about a cave. You may or may not be familiar with this, but in Plato's Republic, Plato tells an allegory of a cave. He's talking about, within the context of talking about education and philosophy and how we teach and all these kind of things, Plato tells us this allegory of the cave, and I'll just paraphrase and I'll just tell it to you briefly. He basically tells, and as I'm talking, if you haven't heard the allegory of the cave, try to think about how Chazal represented the narrative of Rashbi in the cave, Rav Shimon bar Yochai in the cave, and how they might have played with Plato's version. Okay, Plato essentially says that we all live in a world of illusion. And he says, and the way that he described this world of illusion that we all live in is by saying, is through this metaphor of the cave. He says, imagine a cave where a bunch of people are sitting inside the cave in front of a big rock, and their arms are chained to each other or to the rock, and they can't get up at all. And they're there from infancy. All they know is that their particular spot in the cave. They don't know anything else, right? Behind them, kind of like in an ancient movie theater, in an ancient version of a movie theater, there's a fire. And behind the fire, or in front of the fire, actually, there are, different figurines and things like that. Maybe a figure of a tree, a figure of a chair, or whatever. And they're seeing the simulacra, the projection, on the wall of the cave in front of them. They don't know. They can't turn their heads. They don't know that behind them things are being projected, and they see in front of them simulacra. Semblances or resemblances of the chair and whatever. They just see the projections, okay? And they stay like that their whole lives. They think that's reality. They that's all they know. They've been there since they're babies. They don't know anything else. And they're like, oh, chair. Oh, horse. Oh, tree. That's all they know, right? But once in a blue moon, says Plato, one of them is able somehow to recognize that there must be more than this provincial life. And they break loose from the chains and go out of the cave and are blinded by the sun when they get out of the cave. And they see a whole new world. I think I'm invoking various Disney movies and Pixar movies as I'm talking. They see a whole new world of real trees and real horses and real chairs and whatever it is. And that those people, says Plato, are quote-unquote philosopher kings. Their people, this is all supposed to be a metaphor for the masses, most people who live their life in a world of illusion in the cave, seeing what they think is reality, but not really reality. They just see kind of semblances of reality, but they think it's reality because it's all there. They're not sophisticated thinkers. They're simpletons. And they've never realized that there's something beyond the things that are in front of their face, in front of their nose, right? And then once in a blue moon, some really, really a smart person who's able to think really logically and deeply is able to get out of the world of illusion and see real stuff. And he calls that the world of the forms. That's reality, right? So that's Plato's, in a nutshell, Plato's 4th century BCE allegory of the cave that really has a lot of similarity to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. When Plato is discussing the people in the cave, he says their eyes are full of darkness, their vision is dim, their eyes are ruined. But the philosopher king who leaves the cave has real vision. And all these kind of, so Rav Shimon Bar Yochai with his laser vision is an important thing. And so with Bemis too, right? And with his spectacles, whether you have vision or not has to do with, it's not real sight. It's not about, the optical nerve. It's about insight. It's really talking about whether you have insight or not, right? But what's the difference between Plato's allegory of the cave and Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's? The Rav Shimon Bar Yochai narratives. In the Rav Shimon Bar Yochai narratives, the cave is a place of retreat, right? You're retreating from the mundane. You're retreating from worldly pursuits. Whereas, right, that's a world, that is the world of objective reality. That's the world of truth. That's the world of Torah, where all you have is Torah. That's the life of the scholar. That's Kolel. Right? Whereas in Plato's cave, the cave is mundane life, right? The cave is the world of illusion. It's undesirable. It's where the masses are. Objective truth lies outside the cave, right? And so to some extent, the Rashbi narratives, while potentially borrowing from the Plato's metaphor, are an inversion of Plato's metaphor. And ultimately, at the end of the Rashbi narratives, we're seeing that the Gemara and that Chazal advocate leaving the cave, not because the cave is horrible, right? Not because the cave is just for the masses and doesn't have truth. That the cave does have truth. The cave has Torah. But it's advocating integration into the real world, taking what you had at the Beit Midrash and bringing it out and combining it to whatever extent seamlessly into the real world. The sage, the rabbi, the scholar should not stay his whole life or her whole life in the cave, but bring their scholarship out into the real world. Whereas what Plato is saying is get out of that cave, right? Which is mundane life, the life for the masses, and withdraw from that and just be a philosopher king. That's what you should strive for. And once you become a philosopher king, never go back into the cave. Don't regress and go back into your chained position in the cave, into your, you know, inferior status as one of the people in the world of illusion, right? So while Greek philosophy was saying essentially that the sage should always be sage-like and stay in his or her ivory tower, Judaism was using the same imagery to say, adaraba, lehefech, that the sage needs to go out into the real world and become a part of it and contribute to it and make bathhouses and currency and build bridges and institutions and structures, right? I think, you know, especially for lack of time, I'm gonna skip a very, very beautiful concept within Rev Soloveitchik's writings that are especially pertinent and apropos of Sfirat HaOmer, where I'll just tell you very, very briefly, where he talks about essentially Pesach being a time where the Jewish people were bound together by fate, which is very objective, right? Fate is what happens to you. It doesn't have to really do with any with your own experiences or your own behavior or anything like that. It's just fate. It's left up to the powers, right? Fate just happens. That's what Pesach was about. The Jewish people were bound together by fate, whereas Shavuot, the Jewish people are bound together by destiny, which is something that they took into their own hands. And Sfirat HaOmer is a bridge from fate to destiny, right? Where we take matters into our own hands and we say, Naseh v'nishma, we want this. This is not just a matter, it's not just something that's happening to us. We have intention here, we have kavana, and we're choosing this, right? This is out of our own free will. And Rav Soloveitchik relates that to two kinds of typologies of human beings. Rav Soloveitchik talks about a lot of typologies: halachic man, lonely man of faith, ethical man, aesthetic man, tons of different kind of men, which really means human beings, right? And he says, based on a midrash about Hashem creating Adam by collecting dust from here and dust from there, he says there are two kind of typologies. One is cosmic man. Cosmic man is expansive in nature. Cosmic man is adventurous and is mesmerized by the infinite and is drunk with life and wants to go out and see and explore a whole new world, right? And that's one kind of typology. And that's represented by Shavuot, taking matters into our own hands and being adventurous and choosing what am I going to do next and where am I going to go next and what am I going to explore and curiosity and going for it and ambition and all those kind of things. And then there's origin-seeking man. That's what he calls this typology. Origin-seeking man retreats. Origin-seeking man is rooted in a particular time and place or a set of circumstances and seeks stability and familiarity and finds comfort in turning inward and going back home and going back to the source attached to origins, right? And that's the, what he calls the covenant of Goral, the covenant of fate. That's, people that, which is represented by Pesach, people who find comfort in kind of like the status quo and things that are predetermined and fate just happening to them, right? And so it's kind of like when the Rav is talking about this, he's talking about Sefirat HaOmer as a bridge from origin-seeking man, our origins and kind of like Mitzrayim, where we were steeped in there, to then a place of destiny where we took matters into our own hands. We became cosmic man as a nation, and we harnessed our destiny in that way. As we approach Lag BaOmer, I think it would be really cool and interesting, if you have a few more minutes, to look at this very obscure next source with me, okay? Because I think all this ties together really beautifully and very nicely with the sugya that we just looked at. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, in a fascinating comment on a Hasidic Sheminhag of using a bow and arrow on Lag BaOmer, he tells us essentially how the bow and arrow symbolizes what we're supposed to be doing when it comes to the scholarly versus mundane life. And he says, and if you could just, look on your sheet there. He says, the Hasidic texts state that there are two types of weapons, a cherev and a bow, based upon a pasuk that talks about Yaakov telling Yosef that I'm going to give you something a little extra that I took from the Emori. I'm going to give you a cherev and a keshet. And he describes a keshet very beautifully, as being different than a cherev. A sword, he says, is something that can only impact somebody who's close to you, right? Somebody uses a sword, they stab somebody right in front of them, right? You need a certain amount of proximity. You need to be close to the person in order to inflict the harm that you're trying to inflict. Versus a keshet that has the ability to impact people who are farther away. And this is where the Kabbalistic mystical underpinnings of Chassidut, come into how the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, understands that this what we do on Lag BaOmer with the bow and arrow. He says that what we learn or what we see when we use a bow and arrow, or what the inventor, he says, of the bow and arrow was very attuned to, is that in order to reach the farther you want to reach, the more you have to draw in closer to yourself when you use a bow and arrow. So, and this is also in terms of shlichus, right? If you want to reach far, if you want to make a bigger impact, what he says is you have to go, the further you go deeper into your origins, the further you go into the source, go back to your roots, right? The further you draw closer and go inward, origin-seeking man, the farther you can go as cosmic man, right? The Lubavitcher Rebbe and the Rav kind of, not really in conversation with each other, but kind of, in a theoretical kind of way, in conversation with each other. And so Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, by going into retreating into this womb-like Edenic existence in the cave, was then able afterwards, that's why at the end of our sugya is able to make a bigger impact and build structures and currencies and bathhouses and all these kind of things, right? And so on Lag BaOmer, when we're taking this keshet, when we're taking this bow and arrow, it's really very closely connected to the actual, and Lag BaOmer is very much surrounding Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, right? It's not just about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's death or whatever it is. It's very much about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's struggle with and wrestling with how much we retreat into intellectual life and into the world of Torah versus how much we're a part of reality. And the bow and arrow, aside from being the historical thing that they used when the Romans were coming and they wanted to pretend that they're not learning Torah, and so instead they play this game, has deeply mystical, symbolic meaning of wrestling with these two things. And with this, I promise, I'll end very, very soon. If you look further in the Gemara and in the Midrash, you see over and over and over again that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is said to replace a keshet. That as long as Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is alive, says the Gemara and says the Midrash, we no longer need a rainbow. We no longer need a bow and we no longer need a keshet. Isn't that interesting? How this ties together? It says, Rav Chizkiah b'shem Rabbi Yirmiah, kol yamav shel Rav Shimon ben Yochai, lo nir ata hakeshet, or nitra, I don't know if that's a typo, hakeshet ba'anan. As long as Rav Shimon bar Yochai was alive, we didn't need, there was no rainbow when Rav Shimon bar Yochai was around. What does that mean? And I always tell my students that rabbis don't just give us info. They're not just like, newsflash, there was never a rainbow when Rav Shimon bar Yochai was alive. It's trying to tell us something deeper than that. It's trying to say something. It's trying to tell us that you know, this rainbow that we know is supposed to be a symbol of protecting the world. As long as Rav Shimon bar Yochai was around, we didn't need this other protective element. Because Rav Shimon bar Yochai, you remember, becomes the great healer after he comes out of the cave and he learns his lesson. And while his son's eyes were still destroying things, he was going around and he was repairing them. And then he says, after he learns the lesson with the guy running with the flowers, he says, now because this miracle occurred to me, I need to repair the world. He turns from the great destroyer to the great repairer. So as long as the great repairer is around, we no longer need this protective thing called the keshet. And the Medrash Rabba, which is the second to last source on your sheet, tells us, Vayomer Elokim zot ot habrit asher ani notein beini uveinechem v'gomer l'dorot olam amar Rav Yudan l'dorot k'tiv prat l'shnei dorot. When it's talking about the keshet, that this is a sign that I give for me and for you and every living creature and blah blah blah, it says the word dorot chaser, it doesn't have the vavs, the two vavs, and the rabbis try to figure out why it doesn't have these two vavs. And they ultimately, one of them ultimately decides that it's referring to the reason why it's missing these two vavs when it writes the word dorot is because in two generations the keshet was not needed. One of the generations in which the keshet was not needed was the generation of Rav Shimon bar Yochai. And if you read a little on, I'm just gonna paraphrase. Essentially, it's because as long as Rav Shimon bar Yochai was around, they didn't need the rainbow because Rav Shimon bar Yochai was enough in order to protect the world. The presence of Rav Shimon bar Yochai alone protects the world because he's involved, he's an advocate on behalf of the world, he does all these business transactions and sets up all these structures, and he encourages human affairs rather than condemns it. He's taking care of business, Rav Shimon bar Yochai. We don't need the rainbow anymore. We don't need the rainbow or the bow as we don't need the retreating anymore. He retreated and now his impact can be, he's protecting the world and taking care of the world, and his impact is very, very far-reaching. And then we have this really cryptic, very mystical text, which is really, really wacky. We'll just read a little bit of it inside together. And the Zohar, of course, it's the Zohar, right? Where the Zohar tells us that once Rav Shimon bar Yochai went out and saw that the world was dark and cloudy and all the lights had been sealed, he said to his son, Rabbi Eliezer, let us go and see what God has planned for the world. They went and came to one angel that looked like a large mountain with 30 large torches of fire in its mouth. Rav Shimon said, what are you planning to do? He said this angel, this weird kind of monster, I came to destroy the world because there are not 30 righteous people in this generation, for God had thus decreed to Abraham, X, Y, and Z. Rav Shimon said to him, I order you, go in front of God and say to him, Bar Yochai is in the world. I'm here. You can't destroy. You're saying there's not enough tzidkus in the world. There are not enough righteous people. Go remind God, I'm here. I'm the great healer. As long as I'm here, you don't need any protective element or any. I take care of the world. The angel went in front of God and said, Master of the universe, it is known to you what Bar Yochai said to me. God said, go and destroy the world and ignore Bar Yochai. When the angel returned, Rav Shimon saw the angel and said, if you do not leave, I will decree on you that you will not return to heaven. Rather, you will be in a place of Azza and Azael. You'll go to hell, essentially. Go to God and say to him, if there are not 30 righteous, then 20 should suffice. If not 20, then 10 should suffice. If not 10, then 2 should be enough. And there is me and my son. And if 2 is not good, then 1 should be enough. And that is me. Rav Shimon bar Yochai has guts. Right? He says, you go back to God and you tell him, I am here and that you should not be here. He says, I'm not taking no for an answer, right? And it says, "Betzadik yisod olam," a righteous man is the foundation of the world. At that moment, a voice rang out of heaven and said, "Fortune is your portion, Rav Shimon, for God decrees above and you rescind below." See how powerful Rav Shimon, or how powerful the Zohar represents Rav Shimon Bar Yochai as being this powerful, that God decrees and you are able to take away the gezeira of God. Right? He said he almost has divine powers. "Certainly about you the verse is written, the will of those who fear him is done." This is the answer at the end of the day. This is the answer to the question of the relationship between the spiritual sage, you know, in the kolel, in the base medrash, in the cave, and the temporal world, you know, reality. The sage at the end of the day, with the purpose of learning all that Torah in my seminary, right? I'll give a little plug. The purpose of the Shana Ba'aretz, of the year in Israel, is to be in the Ma'ara, is to go back to origins and to go to objective truth. And certainly to be a kolonik for a little while and to learn and to think and to be provided for, right? And not to have to think about making money and what, you know, to really, really learn. But then you have to go out into the rest of the world because tzadik yisod olam, because the world, the existence of the temporal reality is dependent upon you. It's ultimately dependent upon the Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, who spent time in the cave for its existence, for its sustenance. The sage is supposed to interact with the world because the world needs the sage to interact with the world. Without the sage interacting, without the rabbi, without the scholar, without the talmid or talmidah, coming out of kolel or coming out of the Beit Midrash, the world needs a keshet. Then the world needs, all it can rely upon is hopefully God will protect us, right? It needs miracles. But as long as Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's are there, it's not needed. And so the answer, again, that all of this kind of gives us, gives the average Jew, the scholar, you know, all the Jewish people, is that we should be choresh b'shad harishan, zoreya b'shad zriya, and kotzer b'shad ktsira, and dash b'shad disha, but also, you know, beforehand, in preparation for that, to take time to learn, whether we're kovea itim, you know, within the world of temporal existence, or we're a young man or woman who is at the stage of their lives where they can go in the ma'ara, right, and they can live that Edenic existence. We learn Torah, we certainly learn Torah, we make it a part of our lives, but then we take that out into the rest of the world in order to sustain the rest of the world. And so that's in and out of the cave, Rashbi and Plato, on how a Jew is supposed to live. So thank you for learning that with me. Questions, comments, criticisms, I guess. Yeah.
I think the story is very complicated.
Yes.
On the one hand, those who follow Rabbi Yishmael will work in the great Torah and successful. Those who follow Rabbi Shimon and the Lafayette already, they are not successful.
They are sometimes right.
And then the contradiction is that Rabbi Shimon comes to save the world by talking with an angel. So is he right or is he wrong? Should he follow?
Ultimately, I think if we're taking the whole thing as a unit, it's taking us in a process, right? It's taking us in stages until we draw a final conclusion. The final conclusion is that you should live an eternal existence at certain points in your life, right? But then you don't stay in that eternal existence. You bring all of that objective knowledge and learning and dependence and God and all those, you know, that beautiful kind of existence into the real world. Right, that's ultimately the lesson that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai learns. That's where the sugya ends. And they live happily ever after. Then we're done, right? And so you look at what it says before it says, and they live happily ever after, in order to understand what's the message of this whole thing. The message of this whole thing is that you you do both, and you combine both.
What's the name of the program again?
Amudim.
No, no, the Twilight Zone.
Oh! You said my program. Time Enough at Last. Because Bemis says, I have time enough at last with my books. But then some... Time Enough at Last. Enough at Last. I have all the time in the world.
I'm surprised you didn't mention Mel Duffin. The cave and the hiding and the...
Oh, I mean, listen, this is the kind of like... fun stuff, you know, when you're learning, doing kind of like a literary analysis. I would say this is a literary analysis of an Agadah, of an Agadic text. Then you can start to say, ooh, what do caves represent in rabbinic literature? Something like that, right? And see if you can follow it through. When Chazal talk about caves, are they often talking about really Gan Eden or the life of the mind or whatever it's supposed to represent, right? So, that's fun. Yes.
Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, in Ein Torah, Ein Derech Eretz. In Ein Derech Eretz, Ein Torah.
Uh-huh.
And Rabbi Shimon, the son of Rabbi Gamliel, says, in Herod Sheni, Torah, Ein Derech Eretz.
Uh-huh.
Rabbi Shimon, what's an interest in Derech Eretz?
At the end of this, at the end of our sugya, I beg to disagree. I beg to differ, because at the end of the sugya, he is interested in Derech Eretz.
Yeah, but the Gemara says those who followed his path, only learning, were not successful. Those who followed Rabbi Yishmael says you should work and learn towards it.
Right. So what the Gemara is saying, right, it's commenting on Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's initial understanding, wherein you're supposed to only stay in a cave. And the Gemara is saying, people followed that way of thinking, and it didn't work out. So both in Gemara in Shabbos and Gemara in Bracha, which is the one that you just invoked, both of those passages ultimately want us to conclude that initial understand, that initial worldview of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, that you should only stay in a cave, is not the way to go. So it's actually quite consistent. It's not contradictory. Thank you. It's so good to see you. Do you know that we know each other? We know each other. I was on IBA.
Oh my gosh, yes. Bobby, IBA.
Unbelievable.
Maybe we could talk a little bit after. I think there's one more question, but.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was many, many years ago.
No, I think this, I want to ask a question.
I just want to say two things. The first one, well, I'm going to say one thing. The last session that you quoted from the Zohar, 105b.
Yes.
Is very reminiscent in my mind of a book I'm currently reading.
Okay.
It's not.
Is it fantasy?
Well, it's not fantasy. Okay. Actually, science fiction.
Yeah.
It's not Platonic. It's very Aristotelian.
Okay.
It's a pretty famous book, Atlas Shrugged.
Oh yeah, sure.
But I noticed that it's very different in the way that Atlas is portrayed, or the concept of Atlas, versus Shimon Bar Yochai. Because here Shimon Bar Yochai is the one who's holding up the world with his towering,
that's brilliant.
Power,
yeah.
Towering intellect.
Yeah.
But here, it's not him who decides to let the world know that they are in a state of moral decay. It's God. Mm. God decides to, you know, shrug. And
yes.
It's Shimon Bar Yochai who rises to the occasion and is the hero who is the Tzadik Yisrael alum. In that book, it's the character representing Atlas, who himself decides to invoke the punishment on the
amazing
world.
That's really cool.
So just that's a comparison.
Yeah.
Second thing is, I was a little put off by your separation between the life of the mind as being some kind of fake, not real reality versus the real world as something. Which
I'm just the messenger, so you're put off by the Gemara.
Well, so I'm not sure that that's the only way of looking at the Gemara. The
uh-huh.
reason I'm saying that is because from my perspective, if you were to go ask Shimon Bar Yochai about this cognitive status of his life of the mind,
yeah.
I'm sure he would say that is no less real than the so-called real world, even to the point where his thinking is not simply, I'm trying to argue for him, he would say it's kind of necessary for people to engage in this kind of thinking, this kind of theoretical development, in order for practical knowledge to be developed.
So just let's be very precise and look at the discourse, the words that he uses,
yeah.
right? And then we'll understand how he views these two worlds. He compares them by saying one is a life of olam, endlessness, and one is a life of sha'a, time boundliness. I don't know what word. I said temporal, right?
Yeah.
So one is a word of time, a world of timelessness, and one is a world of time. So he's not making a judgment. He's not saying bad world, good world, superior world, inferior world. He's comparing one as being, when I say real and less real, I mean real in the sense that one is time bound, one is functioning within history as human beings experience history, and one is in the cosmos, not time bound. And that's what I meant by less real. It certainly can be as real, but it's an alternate universe to the one that we experience as human beings.
So I'm saying that Shimon Bar Yochai might himself...
It could be just as real.
It's part of his experience as a human being. You see, when he's in that state of mind...
That's where I, as trying to read the Gemara for what the Gemara wants to tell me. Right? As a reader, as the student of the Gemara, right? I hear the Gemara telling me that there's a difference between the reality that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is experiencing, as real or not real as it is, and the reality that's outside that cave. The Gemara, I think it's clear that the Gemara is trying to scream at me, right? Tell me, I'm here. The reason why this sugya in Shabbos is here is to tell me that there's two worlds here, right? And it's begging me to see the difference between those two worlds. There's definitely a dichotomy being created by this specific narrative, right? So my task, the onus is on me as the students, to figure out what two worlds the Gemara is trying to compare and contrast. So there must be some difference, you know, between these things. So that's how I read it. In any case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This was a pleasure.